chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and I have spent the last 24 years as both the CEO of Technology Partners and as the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. I'm thrilled to have Carrie Granite on the show today. Carrie is a film producer, media executive, co-founder, and partner at Destiny Media. Well, Carrie, I am so delighted that you made the time today to be on the Something Extra podcast. Thank you so much for joining me on the show today.
It is truly my honor, Lisa. Thank you so much for thinking of me.
Absolutely. Well, you and I just recently, you'd reached out to me because I'm part of the YPO Christian Fellowship Network, and you had an amazing project that you wanted to let the YPOers know about. And that's how you and I got to start to talk. And then I found out all kinds of things about you. And I said, oh my goodness, Carrie, I really would love it if you'd come onto the podcast. So we've got so much to talk about today. I promise you that listeners will get you out of here in, you know, hopefully 40 minutes. But, you know, I could probably talk to Carrie for hours and hours. But I just appreciate everything you're about, Carrie. And we've just got a lot to talk about. But first of all, let's just start out. You know, you and I have talked offline. I know you grew up in New York, but you're living in Santa Monica right now, right? You're in California.
Yeah, I live in California. I live in Malibu.
And Malibu. Awesome. Very good. So we'll kind of talk about that journey and what took you out there. But tell me a little bit about how you grew up. And I would love for you just kind of tell me what you were like as a child. Because when our listeners find out a little bit about what you're doing today, I would just love to know kind of if there were any genesis as a child with what you're doing today. So
sure.
Tell me a little bit about that.
I think I grew up very fortunately in a very close family. And we, I think we were also a family that was deeply into communication, deeply into kind of reverence of kind of the values of family, and deeply into concepts of curiosity, and curiosity being really promoted and not challenged. And I think that the notion of developing that as a skill set has created for at least, you know, for me for years, a real propensity and kind of desire to keep learning about things. And from a very young age, kind of it was instilled in me this generalized concept that we are all ignorant, that we are ignorant. And if you can accept that and accept that we really don't know many things, and that we really scratch the surface so much, then this journey that we all are on of deeper understanding, deeper connection, becomes ever so more prescient and valuable for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot packed in there, Carrie, because I'm just thinking, number one, for you to have that mindset that really I don't know much, that requires humility, on your part. And, a leader, I think that's one of the amazing qualities of a good leader is to have that humility to know, there's so much more there to learn. The second thing I think about is just, I guess the word that comes to mind is a wonderment. A wonderment about the world and just this quest to learn more and to gain more, and it makes life really exciting. I had several episodes ago I had Ken Blanchard, and I know Ken Blanchard on the show. And Carrie, I will just never forget. I think he is Ken is maybe 84, 85 now. And he's like, you gotta live the last part of your life with gusto. And it's like, I mean, I think about that as you're talking, because that makes you want to live life with gusto, is to know that there's so much more, right, that we can learn.
Well, I think, we've, and we'll talk about media in a minute, I'm sure, but I think we've entered in, each generation has these kind of different levels of kind of overarching kind of messaging that hit people, right? I mean, for a long time we lived in this kind of empirical nature, right? In the 50s, 60s, 70s of kind of Cold War, kind of like overarching different things. And we've went gone through different generations. And today we're kind of living in this kind of generation, which is very troubling to me, of certainty, where people talk with tremendous certainty about everything. And it's become an indefatigable sign of weakness if you kind of admit that you don't know something and that you aren't kind of fully a specialist. And that's kind of plaguing us politically. It's plaguing us in business with leaders. It's plaguing us everywhere. Everybody's a constant specialist, right? So, and a constant knowledgeable source of everything, right? And I think media has played into that. And I think that being able to use media like your show does so well, like your podcast does so well, and getting into these very insightful conversations about making people think about what is either that something extra or what is that, those tipping points in people's lives or their half times, if you want to use Maxwell's book, and other leadership books. But I think we, over the last 10 to maybe 20 years, we've gone into this place of hard solutions, hard answers. And when I grew up, it wasn't really like that. It was very much about kind of really having more Socratic conversations about things and a return to that. And I try and live that with my own kids and wife, where at dinner time it's phones away and let's have a discussion. Let's talk about the day's events and let's talk about things. And that informs more of an openness of worldview to then want to explore and be able to be more curious. And I think that's kind of informed a lot about my view of media.
I love that. That is beautiful. I love the Socratic approach. And sometimes we can get in this trap, can't we, Carrie, of telling, telling, telling. And sometimes it's more the questions. In fact, I read something recently. It said Google said, their secret is not the answers. Their secret is the questions. Right? The questions that you ask. And so I love that you talk about that with your children, and sitting down at dinner and putting your phones away. And I don't know. I just feel like sometimes things can be, it, life can sometimes seem very superficial, right?
And it's
It can
something,
seem very superficial.
and it's something I'm very afraid of. I've obviously, like everybody else, been curious about open AI technologies and various technologies. And while everybody else is trying to get to finite answers using ChatGPT and a bunch of other competitive versions of that, I've tried to figure out how to, how to use OpenAI to ask me better questions about things. Mm-hmm. And that's where it fails, because it's not used to the analytical asking me. So it's used to me programming it to basically help me get to the bottom of something, but not necessarily mm-hmm. come back and have a worldview of asking me questions. Anyway, I don't mean to go into that. But
yeah. Well, that could be for another episode.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because I mean, obviously,
film.
Yeah, yes, you know, and obviously we're a tech company, so you know we're having our clients asking us about this and developing applications, and you know it's just going to be so interesting. But I love what you said. You still sit down with your children, and you're having that conversation with them, Carrie, absolutely. Not ChatGPT, you know, so, or a robot or whatever the case may be. But, you know, it's like technology. There's good things. There's wonderful things. We say we like to say that we harness the power of technology to improve the world. But then when you try to replace the human connection with the technology, that's where I think we can get a little bit off. But, you know, let's get into kind of what you did. You went to Tufts University in Massachusetts, which I know is a really great school. It's considered one of the little Ivies. But, you know, let's get into what you're doing today. So, you know, over your career, Carrie, and I could have this stat wrong, but I think you have produced over 55 films. With box office revenue close to $6 billion, if not more than that. I mean, you've done amazing things. But let me ask you this. What inspired you? How can you connect the dots for us? What inspired you to become a filmmaker?
Sure. Well, first of all, I grew up, like many, being heavily influenced by cinema and films, you know. And I can point to various filmmakers who in different films that at different times in my life have molded, frankly, the way I see the world in different ways. You know, there to be able to laugh and take a step back and look at like the anarchy of how government works. Sometimes one doesn't have to look much further than seeing kind of early films, you know, like Dr. Strangelove and Woody Allen's, you know, Bananas and films like that, to say, you know, these are filmmakers, whether it was Stanley Kubrick or Woody Allen early days in the 70s that captured a look and feel. If you want to understand human, you know, human nature and that the value of relationships at any age, and that you can become close with someone, you know, if you're 22, you could still have a very close relationship with someone as a friend who's 88 years old. You don't have to look much further than Harold and Maude, Hal Ashby's great film, which was so provocative and yet touching at the same time. And so media and film have been extremely impactful. Chariots of Fire being obviously a seminal film in, you know, teaching us about fortitude and values and courage and conviction, and was such a kind of solid rock. Look, I grew up, you know, my vision of what Moses looked like and should, you know, dress like was Charlton Heston. And, you know, there was no question that that was what Moses was. And, right. You know, there was no question that, you know, he raised, you know, his staff and parted that Red Sea and called upon God. And, you know, so we all have grown up with these kind of like seminal images that shaped us. And for me, I wanted to tell those stories. And I think the very first short film that I did actually was a priest that was struggling with the a priest that was called Virginia Creeper, and it dealt with a priest that was struggling with the precepts that were being instituted in Vatican II and how it drove him insane, and literally dealt with kind of religion at a very deep level, very quickly. And tried to understand that. And I've always seen film as a way to communicate very topical stories. And don't get me wrong, I've had different generations of film.
Yes.
Definitely. I also see film as a sociologist sometimes might see life, or an anthropologist might see life. So as a sociologist, I try and study, most importantly with films, like who's the audience we're trying to make content for. And then making sure that we're stepping five steps ahead of them, not behind them. And so by staying five steps ahead, you have to really understand where are these demographics, where are these people going, not where they've been. So we built a very successful in the 90s genre label called Dimension, which was a sister company to Miramax. And we saw that at the time, certainly from 1990s, there was a very, you know, we were just becoming, and teenagers were becoming very narcissistic, nihilistic, and cynical. And we, you know, created an entertainment kind of studio that was playing into that with content and great filmmakers. But, you know, we're making films that were dark, and the films like Scream and Scary Movie, which was a comedy, and, you know, Dust Till Dawn and The Others. And we also had the honor of, you know, being part of the first Lord of the Rings. But I had a tipping point for myself when I started having kids, and I realized media is extremely powerful. And
absolutely.
We were making, you know, I'm very proud of the quality of the filmmakers and what we were doing. We launched many franchises of films back then. But I also realized that the power of media was such that we needed to use media to reinstill values, reinstill kind of a sense of belief, reinstill all these kind of things that have been lost, kind of trust. And that's in 2000, I made a very difficult decision, which was we had built this extremely successful multi-billion dollar operation that was a sister company to Miramax. And I had just done Spy Kids. I had just done the first Scary Movie and just done The Others. So three films that each of them had grossed north of 100 million and was on their way to each being kind of franchise oriented. And I left the company and made a very strong decision that I was going to leave and create a company called Walden, Walden Media, Walden Films, Walden Books, with the premise of really recapturing a sense of imagination, becoming kind of a catalyst for curiosity and reinstilling values again. And I had the opportunity to do this with a college roommate of mine who came out of the world of publishing and education. And together we built this plan to say, you know, Walden was going to follow the precepts of Henry David Thoreau, which was live life deliberately. And we were going to focus on a demographic that was what we considered like under attack. Forget about underserved. A demographic that was under attack. And that demographic was the family demographic, the family audience, and specifically kids ages 8 years old through 14 was our battleground, because we considered middle school the place where kids would either lose their imagination, lose their sense of self, and become much more cynical after that, or we could capture them and repivot them. So our whole focus was, that was our Normandy Beach. That was our place of saying our battleground would be middle school for kids. And we were going to basically take that and own that. And, you know, we recognized we were coming into a marketplace where people kept saying, well, there's Disney, there's Scholastic, you're kind of in between. And what are you going to do? Create a brand that stands for kind of like schooly media, school. You know, it's going to be, and we reached a point where we were passed on so many times by investors who, you know, everybody, when I went into a meeting, offered me an untold amount of money to build another genre studio, of course, because I had just built one. And they just were like, well, if you want to make another one of those, we'll give you whatever you want. But family, entertainment, education, that's what Disney does. Mm-hmm. That's what Scholastic does.
Right.
And, but we really do.
But yours was different. Yours was different, you know, Carrie, and you got the rights to, and go ahead and tell our listeners, you got the rights to the C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, right?
Well, we were very fortunate to get the, you know, to partner with the C.S. Lewis estate. and
Mm-hmm.
they had had a very tough time in Hollywood for 15 years straight of studios developing versions of the franchise that were really, kind of interpretations, but not the actual intention of C.S. Lewis. And we worked very hard to gain the trust of the estate. And that was a big process. And we were very grateful that Douglas Gresham, who's really one of the key stewards, and Rudy Seibert and Melvin Adams, and the key players who were running the estate at the time, trusted us. And especially Douglas Gresham, C.S. Lewis's son. Yeah, that was a big responsibility, getting the rights to that. We
Absolutely.
frankly, every film that we made, that we felt we had an enormous responsibility. Telling the story of William Wilberforce and John Newton was an incredible
Yeah.
responsibility to get right with Amazing Grace as a film.
Amazing Grace. Yes. And listeners, if you have not seen that, please go and watch it. It's just a phenomenal, phenomenal
Yeah, I
film.
mean, I would say Amazing Grace today, especially with where we are in the world of politics around the world, that film is kind of like a must-see for people, because it's just a whole different generation of politicians who fought through, by their values. And
Yes.
but the Narnia films was one of the greatest highlights of my life, to be able to work on
Yeah.
that with people and the team, that we assembled to make that. You have to understand, when you make a film like Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, that's building a company with 3,800 people in staff, so to speak. Because, and if you do it for 4 or 5 years in multiple divisions and visual, and we had to create visual effects that, just like Lord of the Rings, weren't yet created just to make the film.
Yeah, so incredible. I mean, that's Carrie. When I met you, I'm like, Carrie, you did Chronicles of Narnia, because I remember our kids, watching all of those. Yeah, I just you did Holes, Bridge to Terabithia, Charlotte's Web, so many great, great films there. But you know what? I want to talk to you a little bit. We need to take a quick break, and then we'll come right back. And I want to talk to you about the making of a film,
Sure.
because our listeners may not really understand that. And then I've got a few other questions
Of
about,
course.
respecting the artistic vision versus, obviously sometimes you've got to make sure the monetization is right so you don't lose your shirt when you're making these films. So we'll talk about a few other things, but we do need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Cary Grant on the Something Extra podcast.
Hey there. In a challenging business climate like this, savvy leaders look to technology to find an edge. This can mean the difference between staying ahead of the curve or playing catch up. It's time to collaborate with the highly skilled experts at Technology Partners. Our team of technologists draws upon decades of experience for your project, with each bringing a passion for solving problems and a track record of success. How can we help you overcome your biggest technology challenges? Visit technologypartners.net to book a free consultation with one of our leaders.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with my friend, Cary Grant. So we've been talking about all kinds of things. Cary's an amazing studio executive, film producer, just an amazing human being. And, but we've talked about a lot of different things, but I wanted Cary to tell you guys a little bit. When you started at Universal, Cary, you developed this close mentor-mentee relationship with Tom Pollock. And Tom, at the time, I think, was the chairman of Universal Pictures. People may not know his name, but I think he was involved in Jurassic Park, Ghostbusters, a lot of different things. And I kind of read a little bit about him, Cary, but I want you to tell our listeners more. Said that really he was known for being very respectful of a filmmaker's vision and taking risk. He was never a passive participant. He had a thirst for knowledge, and he was always loyal. And I think I'm sure our listeners probably saw the film Field of Dreams, and I think he was that had been turned down by every Hollywood studio. And I think Tom took a chance on that film. And of course, we know how wildly successful that was.
Well, Tom may he rest in peace. Tom was first off one of the legendary attorneys in Hollywood who redefined what it even meant to be an attorney, because he was an attorney, agent, visionary. And Tom and his partner Jake Bloom and Peter Deckham ran Pollock Bloom Deckham for years, and Tom was the one who represented George Lucas in the 70s and represented many of the biggest filmmakers and brands pretty much in the world. Their law firm kind of defined and shaped Hollywood for years. Tom was kind of the architect of the famous deal for George Lucas when Fox was not sure that they wanted to make a space Western and it's mythic, you know, today. And that one of the ways that Tom kind of renegotiated that deal was limiting, I said Universal Fox. When Fox was making the film, Tom basically came in and figured out a way to negotiate the deal where he allowed George Lucas to own the merchandise rights to Star Wars. And at the time, Fox didn't really think too much of those rights because they don't see it in the same way, and no one expected it. He also retained a certain amount of controls, sequel rights, prequel rights. And so Tom kind of did the most, you know, arguably one of the most historic multi-billion dollar deals in history with that transaction and many others. And then Tom ran Universal, got brought in by Lou Osterman and Sid Sheinberg to become chairman of the studio. And Tom had the head of the studio under him was Casey Silver, and then under him, Al Lieberman. But I got to know Tom, and I shouldn't have because I was too low on the totem pole initially, but I got to know Tom probably because I got fired more times from the studio during my time. I was very young as a studio executive. I was literally like 22, 23 years old, way over my head in a system that was very regimented. And we had just been bought by, MCA had been bought by Matsuhisha out of Japan. And we were in this corporate place. And, you know, as a system, I would do things like, you know, crazy things like say to everybody, hey, listen, I think we should do an overall deal with Richard Branson and start a film label with him, and actually brought him in. And that really wasn't part of my pay grade, which was much lower. And so we'd get reprimanded for doing things like that. Or I actually, you know, there's a young animator named Mike Judge, who I was a big supporter of and helped bring into Hollywood. And Mike ended up creating, you know, Beavis and Butthead and Office Space and Silicon Valley, the TV show, and many, many others that you know, that he was known for. And I tried to do a gigantic overall deal for him. And again, got, I think, fired for that. So each time I would get kind of like over my heels, Tom would laugh and would basically call me up and laugh and say, come up and see me. And we would talk, and he would say, what are you trying to do? And I would say, you know, Tom, the system's not working and we need to rethink things. And he loved that. And he was the first person I met who really encouraged me to kind of think outside the box. And eventually he gave me kind of a joint title as also being in the office of the chairman with him. And it was Tom, more than anybody, who actually encouraged me when I was being pursued by the team in New York to come in as an senior executive right after Miramax got bought by Disney to help build this sister company, Dimension. Tom was the one who said, you just got to follow your passion right now and see where this takes you and take the risk. And Tom was as cautious as Tom was, because he was very cautious. Like, you know, Tom was the kind of person who would come into a meeting when we were making Babe the sheep pig, and he would basically say, I get it. You know, we have to limit the budget because it feels like we're just promoting vegetarianism with this movie. And we have this whole conversation. But at the same time, he was a great supporter of filmmakers and very practical. Tom was also taught me one big thing, which was information. And that the key in making a film is, and the key in what you're doing has to be knowing as much as you can. And again, being ignorant that you're ignorant, Tom was always about who can you line up to constantly get you information in your sphere? And his big teaching to me was, especially when you're making a film, don't rely just on the typical hierarchy to get information of you, the line producer, UPM. You need to be in touch with department heads. You need to be in touch with individuals on that set. You need to walk that set. You need to get that. So he was a very good kind of mentor in that way.
I love that. You know, you could probably write a book, Carrie. Seriously, you probably are thinking about that already, but I'm just thinking of all the things that you've learned, and especially for aspiring young filmmakers. But let me ask you a question. So I think you've already, I was going to ask you, what do you believe is the most important quality for a film producer? But boy, you've just already answered a bunch there for me. You know, like thinking out of the box, obviously being a visionary, getting more information, not just up and down, but also laterally.
But there's one thing more than anything else that's important. You are the head creative producer, when you're the head of a studio or head of a company that's responsible, there's a reason why you want to make a movie. And there's a reason that you set out to make that movie. And it's your job above everything else to never forget the idealized version of the movie that you've set out to make. Because the minute you start giving up on that, and the minute you start giving up on that penultimate vision and compromising, then you're no longer making that version of a movie, and you have no clue where it could go. And therein is the biggest challenge of making a movie process-wise. When you make a movie process-wise, you work so hard and you develop an incredible script that might be an adaptation of a book like Charlotte's Web or Narnia, like we've done. Then you bring on a director, and you have to make sure that you and the director really see eye to eye on the making of the film. And maybe that director even leans more into your vision, like Andrew Adamson did with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Andrew was, you know, in love with it since he was a child himself, and it was a very important book. And Andrew had created Shrek before that, you know, had really done great, great work. But then you start to bring in actors, and those actors feel like they have to interpret something that might be different than you had written on the page and envisioned. And then you have to deal with your crew. Maybe your cinematographer is not shooting it in a way, you know, or is shooting it in a lens with a very specific filter that you didn't even think of. And then you get into all the other elements that you never think can take away from your vision, like the score, which can take you out of a scene versus putting you in a scene, or music in a film. And then, of course, how the film is edited. You have a vision, again, that started out when you were making the decision to go make this film, but then it's edited in a way that looks nothing like that vision. So every step of the process in this 3-year journey of making a movie is like a battle. And it's a constant battle to remember, hey, I have landed here on this beach to go take that city over there. And I can't be taking detours left and right, because then I'll never get to that city. And so, you know, that's a very big thing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, as you're describing it, there's such complexity there.
Oh, yeah.
Really, Carrie, you know, because there's so many different players and there's so many different moving parts. Well, let me ask you this, and I don't know if you can quickly do this or not, but, you know, how do you go about, like, walk us through the process, if you would, just a shortened version of producing a film and bringing it to the silver screen? Because, you know, I don't know, a lot of our listeners may not live in this space, you know, but what, I mean, I've got 20 different questions here, but I'm going to just pick a few more because we don't have that kind of time. But can you walk us through a shortened process of that? And then also, like, maybe part of that process is, I am sure, Carrie, you are getting screenplays, you are getting things on your desk every day, I'm sure, with people saying, you know, hey, look, I've got this project. How do you first figure out which projects that you're going to go for?
Well, today, you know, I'll answer that question. I like to believe that we have a new company, a new studio brand called Destiny, which is kind of the new Walden 2.0. And we have a filter right now, which is very similar to the Walden filter, which is we're trying to go back to making great family films that have strong values, that have kids mainly in leadership and proactive roles. So I look for material, number one, that has great lessons that kids are learning themselves, great lessons mm-hmm. that kids are seeking out themselves. Or I look for projects that have such strong values or reconnection to faith themes that no one's ever done before. That can be all family co-viewing experiences. So those are things I look for. So in the case of a film that we're in, you know, early stage production on now, in the beginning, we wanted to, you know, for years and years and years, I've been wanting to make a film that really reinstilled a sense of gratitude for people and a sense of belief and trust and faith. And one way to do that is to remind the world, you know, through media, that God created the world for us. And how do you do that? Well, you make the story of creation. And that's what we're doing. We've taken our time to develop this, but we're making a big budget version of the creation story. And we are very focused right now on, in this process, I think I'll just answer it, of starting out with our source material, which was Genesis. You know, New Living Translation was our basis. You know, we could have used mm-hmm. a lot of different versions, but we chose that sure. one. We then put together for that film an advisory council made up of the top theologians and people from around the world, and who every week we've been meeting and sharing with them ideas to make sure that this is consistent as a process. And then we also bring in worldwide organizations as our partners, and we have a great director named David Cunningham on that. And that's a project where we budget it and we kind of set our schedule, and we know that we want to release the film at Easter 2025. So we work backwards from that on mm-hmm. visual effects. We bring in great visual effects people. And then daily, you know, every day that kind of I'm out there, I'm reviewing visual effects. I'm reviewing art that's coming in. We're reviewing all different elements to, you know, supervise the project to make sure, because I know at the end of the day that an 8-year-old is going to go into that cinema and walk out and forevermore believe that was how creation was done. So it's an enormous mm-hmm. responsibility to get it right.
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is an enormous responsibility, but how special is that going to be, Carrie?
Very special.
Yes, it is. So that's going to be Easter, you're saying?
We want to have the film come out Easter 2025. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're starting with the end of mind, to borrow a line from Covey, right?
Oh, yes.
And you work backwards from that, you know? Yeah. So, well, you let us know, keep us posted
of
on
course.
How that's going.
Of course.
So that's exciting. So let me ask you one other question, and then I would love for you to talk, you know, anything else that you want to tell us about Destiny. I'm excited about this.
Sure.
Walden 2.0. It's awesome. I'm so excited about what you're doing there. And then we'll talk about something extra. But, you know, where do you think, you know, because like the world in technology, we are always say disrupt or be disrupted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we always have to be innovative anticipators of what's coming around the bend, Carrie, you know, or you're going to get left in the dust. Where do you see that disruption coming in the film industry?
I don't think the disruption is going to be in technology as much as it's going to be in the connection between grassroots and storytelling. And what I mean by that is, again, to point to in the beginning, the disruption is going to be people who start to realize, wait a second, what if I actually built a program or programs that could recognize that 140 million people around the world are going to see this and then walk out the cinema, and then I'm literally ready for them to now go do things with that energy that they've come out of the cinema with.
Mm-hmm.
and they're going to now go out and change X, Y, and Z. And I've literally put the pieces in place for them to do that. That's where the change is going to come. It's not going to just be, hey, it's OpenAI, but what if you made something, you know, and it actually created a change?
Of movement, you know, creating movement.
So years ago,
we
did a series of robotics. We did a series of films with James Cameron where Jim went down to the bottom of the ocean and we did all of this research. And from that, we tied that in with an entire movement that we were part of on teaching kids robotics in school and STEM. And this was 2000, 2001. And today, looking backwards, 25 plus years later, we're so proud of the fact that the Lego League and the first Robotics League reach over 140 million kids a year. That changed dramatically. That was a movement that changed things, you know. And when you have a piece of, you know, people talk about, oh, I want to have this movie impact people, and I think if they see it, the answer is it's never just enough alone. It has to have an entire ground game associated with it. So think about it like a pastor gets up and gives an impactful sermon on the importance of Sandra Stanley, God bless her, talks about foster care issues with, you know, children around the world. She doesn't just talk about it. Andy Stanley at Northway doesn't just talk about it. They literally created the most comprehensive foster program I've ever seen that's church-led in the country. And they've made a difference. So if you can make a film have that same impact with a program, that's where I think media is going to have its biggest impact.
Yeah, that's legacy.
Yeah.
That's legacy, Harry. Well, let me ask you this. This is called Something Extra. I have to ask you, what is the something extra that you believe every leader needs?
I think the something extra that each leader needs is, as I said at the beginning, to know that they don't know everything, and to really, really never stop resting until they've asked 10 questions in the morning and 10 more questions at the end of the night that they're still unsatisfied with, you know, to keep going. And then to have a very specific, you know, vision, you know, and being able to hold that vision. And that something extra has to be, you need to be the one to champion that mobilization, that mission to your company, to your audience, to your demographic, to everybody around you. No one else will.
Yeah.
As effectively as you.
Right. No, that is so good. Well, Carrie, literally, I think I could talk to you for hours and hours and hours. So we need to do this again.
Well, you're so kind to have me on. Love your podcast and the influence that it has. And thank you so much for inviting me to be here today.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.